So, imagine you were trying to build the next massive AI startup. You have the venture capital secured, your engineering team is assembled, and you're holding these architectural blueprints.
Right, blueprints for a gigawatt scale data center.
Exactly. The kind of facility that you are convinced will completely shift the tectonic plates of the industry. So, you go to your local regional transmission organization, the utility consortium, and you tell them you are ready to plug your massive server farms into the grid.
And you think it's going to be a simple process?
Right. But the utility rep just looks at your projected power draw, types a few things into their system, and calmly informs you that you will have to wait 50 months.
Yeah, 50 months.
That's more than 4 years, just to get the physical interconnection and permitting approved to draw power. By the time you can legally flip the switch, your hardware is obsolete, your funding is dried up, and, well, your competitors have lapped you.
It's honestly the defining structural bottleneck of our current technological era. I mean, you have software and silicon evolving at this exponential, almost incomprehensible curve.
Right.
But they are slamming headfirst into a physical infrastructure model that moves at the speed of bureaucratic concrete. The entire innovation pipeline is just being choked by the legacy transmission system.
And that friction point is the entire mission of today's deep dive. We're looking at a radically new, completely off-grid solution designed to bypass that 50-month waiting room entirely.
Yes, the architecture is called the sovereign node.
It's a fascinating concept. We're parsing through a stack of incredibly dense technical and engineering reports from two companies that partnered on this. First is Deriticular, who builds the artificial intelligence and the edge computing architecture.
And the second is Agridot Energy, who engineers the physical thermodynamics.
Yeah, and what they're doing is merging extreme heat agricultural waste gasification with high-performance computing in a way that is, frankly, mind-bending.
It really is. But to really grasp the magnitude of what they're attempting, we first have to understand why the current system is failing so spectacularly.
Right, what the engineers in these reports refer to simply as the line.
Exactly. The line is the centralized grid. Power plants generate electricity far away, and high-voltage transmission lines carry it hundreds of miles to where it's consumed.
Which was great back in the day, right?
Oh, absolutely. That architecture was brilliant for the 20th century. It was designed for large, predictable populations running refrigerators and factory floors.
But not for AI.
No, it was never designed for gigawatt-scale AI training
I'd
clusters.
always just assumed power was power. Like when I think of a data center, I just picture a very steady, massive hum of electricity. Why is an AI data center so fundamentally different from, say, a giant automotive plant?
Well, the difference lies in the volatility of the load. A traditional manufacturing plant has a relatively smooth, predictable power consumption curve.
Because they know the schedule.
Right. The utility knows when the first shift arrives, when the heavy machinery spins up. But an AI training cluster running massive parameter models operates on pulsed loads.
Pulsed loads, what does that look like in practice?
So when a distributed machine learning training run initiates across tens of thousands of GPUs, the power demand doesn't just ramp up gradually.
It just hits all at once.
Exactly. It instantly spikes by hundreds of megawatts in a fraction of a second, as every single piece of silicon suddenly demands maximum current.
Wow. So it's a kinetic shock to the grid. It's not a steady stream of water. It's like trying to flush a million toilets at the exact same millisecond.
That is a very accurate, if slightly gross, analogy. It's a massive, violent pulse of electrical demand, and that creates severe thermal power coupling issues.
Because the grid can't handle the sudden pull.
Right. When you pull that much current that fast, you trigger rapid transient voltage drops across the local grid infrastructure. The substations struggle to maintain the required voltage.
And if they fail?
If those voltage drops cascade, you trip the safety relays and you plunge entire surrounding neighborhoods or even whole industrial parks into localized blackouts.
So the utility companies literally cannot allow you to connect because your demand profile will destabilize their entire regional network.
Precisely. To fix it, the utility has to build new substations, lay thicker high-voltage lines, and conduct years of environmental impact reviews just to handle your specific violent power spikes.
And that right there is the permitting wall the reports mention.
Yes, the capital expenditure and the lead times to upgrade the line are suffocating the deployment of AI infrastructure.
Which means the alternative has to be something that doesn't rely on the line at all. And that's where Deriticular and Agridot Energy come in with what they call the node.
Yes, the node. It's a decentralized, producer-centric, spherical network.
I noticed the reports constantly use the term island mode.
Because these units do not connect to the utility grid at all. They don't pull power and they don't push power.
And because of that, they don't need a 50-month interconnection study.
Exactly. They generate their own power locally, consume it instantly to process AI inference tasks, and then beam the resulting high-value digital data up to satellite networks.
It completely abstracts the physical constraints of geography. I mean, you no longer have to build your data center next to a massive hydroelectric dam or a nuclear plant.
You can deploy compute literally wherever you want.
But, before we can understand how an AI manages this entire system, we really have to look at the physical environment of the node itself.
It's a very unique sandbox.
Definitely. So I want you to picture a standard 40-foot ISO shipping container, the exact kind you see stacked on cargo ships. But this specific container is sitting in the middle of a rural agricultural field.
And inside, it's divided into two distinct halves.
Right. In one half, you have a 1500 degrees Celsius industrial furnace, and in the other half, sitting just feet away, is a rack of highly sensitive, delicate computer servers.
Putting those two things inside the same steel box sounds like a mechanical engineering nightmare.
It really does.
The environmental tolerances for silicon processors and industrial furnaces are just inherently at war with each other.
Yeah, they call the entire chassis the sovereign pod. So let's break down Chamber A first. This is the operational technology zone, engineered by Agridot Energy.
Right, this is the muscle of the operation.
And the heart of Chamber A is a modular plasma arc gasifier.
Now, when most people hear gasification, they just picture an incinerator burning trash. But plasma arc gasification is an entirely different state of physics.
Wait, so it's not burning the waste?
Not at all. Burning is combustion, which requires oxygen and produces a lot of dirty byproducts like ash and noxious emissions.
Okay, so how is a plasma different?
A plasma arc gasifier operates in an oxygen-starved environment. It uses high-voltage electrical currents passed through a gas to create plasma, the fourth state of matter.
Wow.
And we are talking about operating temperatures around 1500 degrees Celsius. That is literally hotter than the melting point of standard steel.
That's insane. And what exactly are they feeding into this plasma arc?
Negative cost organic waste. The unit is designed to intake things like hemp curd from agricultural processing, cow manure, wood chips, even shredded rubber tires.
Stuff that farms and municipalities usually have to pay to get rid of.
Exactly.
So they take this negative cost garbage, and when it hits that 1500 degree plasma, what actually happens to it if it isn't burning?
Molecular dissociation. The sheer thermal energy of the plasma rips the chemical bonds of the waste apart.
It just shatters them.
Yeah. The complex hydrocarbon molecules, the messy stuff that makes up a tire or a piece of wood, are shattered down to their fundamental atomic components.
That sounds like science fiction.
It does, but it's very real. Once ripped apart, they naturally recombine into a very simple, highly purified gas mixture, primarily composed of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. This is known as baseload syngas.
Okay, so you essentially take chaotic, dirty waste and use extreme physics to force it into a clean, predictable, synthetic gas.
Right.
And then you can take that syngas, pipe it into an internal combustion engine or a turbine, and generate raw electricity to power the AI servers.
You can, and that is its primary electrical generation pathway. But Chamber A also houses a secondary chemical pathway.
Right, the compact gas to liquids, or GTL synthesis unit.
Yes.
And this relies on a Fischer-Tropsch catalyst reactor. The chemistry here is fascinating because it goes all the way back to the 1920s.
German chemists invented it, right?
Yeah, they invented it to make liquid fuel out of coal when they didn't have access to crude oil.
The historical parallel is striking, honestly, because it's the exact same problem of resource isolation just applied to a localized container.
So how does the Fischer-Tropsch process work in this container?
It takes that purified syngas, the carbon monoxide and hydrogen, and runs it over a proprietary cobalt or iron catalyst bed under very specific temperature and pressure conditions.
And as the gas passes over the catalyst, the molecules start linking up.
Exactly. It polymerizes them. It forces the simple carbon and hydrogen atoms to link together into long-chain hydrocarbons. It literally synthesizes physical liquid fuel out of the gas.
That's incredible. And the byproduct Agridot produces is branded as Advanced Synthetic Fuel, or ASF.
Yes, ASF.
And the technical specs point out that ASF isn't some experimental biosludge. It strictly meets ASTM D975 specifications.
Which is the legal standardized requirement for conventional diesel fuel.
Right. It is a one-to-one drop-in replacement. You could pour it directly into a tractor or a semi-truck right out of the container.
And here's the best part. Because it's synthesized from atmospheric carbon that was recently absorbed by the agricultural waste, like the hemp plants, rather than pulled from ancient underground oil reserves.
Like a carbon negative.
The resulting fuel is entirely carbon negative. So chamber A gives the node two distinct physical outputs. It can produce electrons to power local computing, or it can produce dense liquid hydrocarbon molecules to store that energy indefinitely.
But to stabilize the electrical generation, chamber A also contains the Swarm BS, right? A localized battery energy storage system.
Yes. They utilize lithium iron phosphate, or LFP, battery cells.
Why LFP specifically?
Well, LFP is much safer and degrades slower than the lithium ion chemistries you find in, say, consumer electronics, but it is still highly sensitive to its thermal environment.
Right. If you let batteries get too hot, you risk thermal runaway and fire.
And if they get too cold, the lithium plating inside the cells slows down and you lose discharge capacity.
So they have to manage that temperature perfectly.
Managing that requires an active thermal balancing loop. The system pumps a dielectric coolant fluid through the battery racks to maintain the internal cell temperatures rigidly between 25 and 35 degrees Celsius.
That's a pretty tight window.
It's non-negotiable. Because those volatile pulse loads we discussed earlier, the AI processors demanding massive spikes of power put extreme mechanical stress on the chemical structure of the batteries.
Wow. Okay, so that covers the muscle. That brings us over to chamber B, the information technology zone.
Yes. If chamber A is the muscle, chamber B is the brain.
And this is dereticular's domain. The server rack inside is called the Sentry Pro server stack. Now, a standard hyperscale data center uses massive HVAC chillers and tens of thousands of screaming fans to keep the chips from melting.
But the Sentry Pro stack is entirely fanless.
Completely fanless. How?
Well, moving parts are a huge liability in a remote, zero-maintenance environment. Fans pull in dust, they have bearings that wear out, and they consume parasitic power.
So what do they use instead?
To achieve a fanless design, dereticular utilizes highly specialized AMD EPYC or ARM64 architecture processors, and they pair those with customized tensor processing units for the AI workloads.
And the reports state they're getting up to 1 teraflop of edge inference capability. But the chips have a maximum continuous thermal design power of just 45 watts.
That is a tiny fraction of what a standard data center GPU pulls.
Yeah, how is that possible?
They are heavily undervolted and engineered for extreme efficiency. But you have to remember, even with low power chips, they're still sharing a steel box with a 1500 degree industrial furnace.
Right, the heat has to be an issue.
And it's not just the heat they have to worry about. The physical violence of chamber A is extreme.
Because of the shredders.
Exactly. The gasifier intake uses dual-shaft industrial shredders to physically tear apart wood and rubber before feeding it into the plasma arc.
The kinetic vibration from grinding up rubber tires would turn a delicate silicon motherboard to dust. I mean, the micro-abrasions would fracture the microscopic solder joints holding the chips in place.
That physical shockwave is exactly why the entire Sentry Pro computing rack is not bolted to the floor.
Wait. It's not bolted down?
No, it is mounted on an active hydraulic kinetic dampening suspension system.
Like a shock absorber.
Think of the suspension on a high-end off-road racing vehicle. It allows the chassis to float smoothly while the wheels are slamming into boulders.
That's a great image.
Sensors detect the mechanical resonance of the shredders in chamber A and dynamically adjust the hydraulic pressure in the mounts. The specifications mandate that the displacement of the server rack must remain under 0.01 millimeters, even when the shredders are at maximum torque.
So it's literally absorbing an earthquake in real time, so the servers don't feel a thing.
Exactly. But there is a secondary invisible threat from the plasma arc.
Electromagnetic interference, EMI.
Right. Sustaining a 1500-degree plasma field requires massive amounts of electrical current. And passing that much current through the electrodes generates a chaotic, high-intensity electromagnetic field that radiates outward.
And if that invisible wave washed over the server rack, it would induce rogue electrical currents directly inside the silicon pathways of the processors.
It would corrupt the data instantly and likely physically fry the chips.
So how do they stop that?
To prevent that, chamber B acts as a specialized Faraday cage. The interior walls dividing the chambers are lined with a high-attenuation copper mesh.
And the mesh just blocks it.
As the electromagnetic waves hit the mesh, the conductive copper intercepts the energy, absorbs the charge, and safely grounds it into the earth.
Wow.
It provides over 80 decibels of attenuation. It creates an absolute dead zone for EMI around the servers.
Okay, so we have these two wildly different environments inside this one box. Chamber A is violent, vibrating and superheated. Chamber B is perfectly still, shielded, and delicate.
But they are not actually isolated from each other.
Right. They are deeply mechanically intertwined through what Agardot calls the Velcro principle.
Thermodynamic coupling. You know, in a traditional system, waste heat is just an engineering nuisance you have to vent into the atmosphere.
But in an isolated system like this, every joule of energy is precious.
Exactly. Even ultra-efficient 45-watt processors generate heat when they run complex AI models.
And over in Chamber A, the incoming agricultural waste, the manure and the hemp, is often saturated with water.
And wet feedstock is the enemy of plasma gasification, because the thermal energy ends up boiling the water instead of breaking down the carbon molecules.
It completely collapses the thermal efficiency of the arc.
It does.
So to solve both problems, they built a liquid coolant loop. The coolant fluid flows through the physical heat sinks on the Sentry Pro GPUs, absorbing the computational waste heat.
And by the time the coolant exits the server rack, its temperature has risen to between 65 and 75 degrees Celsius.
And they hydraulically pipe that hot fluid across the dividing wall into Chamber A and circulate it through heating coils wrapped around the feedstock intake hoppers.
So the waste heat from the AI computing literally bakes the moisture out of the manure before it drops into the gasifier.
It reminds me of those old survival tricks where you wrap a potato in tinfoil and strap it to your car's exhaust manifold before a long drive. You're taking the waste heat your engine is already making and repurposing it to cook your dinner.
The thermodynamic principle is identical, just applied with industrial precision.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, though, because this sounds brilliant on paper, but you are pumping pressurized liquid directly out of a rack of multi-million dollar AI processors and sending it into an environment with vibrating industrial shredders and 1500 degree furnaces.
It's definitely risky.
If one single joint cracks from the vibration or a pipe bursts, you dump coolant everywhere and your entire computing cluster is destroyed. I mean, isn't that an unacceptable single point of failure?
The mechanical engineering gap analysis heavily scrutinized that exact vulnerability. The lack of total physical isolation between the liquid cooling loops and the volatile gasifier environment is actually the highest risk factor in the entire pod.
So why do it?
Because they mathematically proved that they have to take that risk. The efficiency gains are what make the entire node economically viable.
The payoff offsets the plumbing risk.
Absolutely. The system uses near-infrared spectroscopy NIR lasers mounted inside the intake hoppers.
What do the lasers do?
These lasers bounce light off the incoming organic waste to instantly calculate its exact moisture content. The system then dynamically throttles the flow rate of the 75-degree server coolant to perfectly match the drying requirement of that specific batch of waste.
Oh, wow. So it's perfectly tuned.
Exactly. Because they aren't wasting gasifier energy boiling water, they achieve a 12.2% circulant thermodynamic recovery rate.
They reduce the total energy requirement of the entire physical plant by 12.2%. Just by letting the AI's heat do the drawing.
It creates this symbiotic thermodynamic loop that pushes the efficiency metrics far beyond what either system could achieve independently.
Which brings us to the operational reality of this system. We have a shipping container sitting in a field. It can take raw organic waste, gasify it, and then it has a choice.
Right. The node has to decide what to do next.
It can spin a generator to make electricity to power its own AI servers, or it can route the gas into the Fischer-Tropsch reactor to synthesize physical liquid diesel fuel. How does it know what to do? There's no human operator sitting in there pulling levers.
The entire localized decision matrix is governed autonomously by an AI agent operating on the OpenClaw framework.
And Agardot engineers named this specific agent the Industrial Foreman.
Yes.
So the Industrial Foreman is the brain running the pod. It's not just a thermostat turning things on and off. It's an economic agent evaluating the market in real time.
It operates entirely on an algorithm that calculates the spark spread arbitrage coefficient.
In the engineering documentation, this is denoted as CSSA.
Exactly. The Industrial Foreman runs this mathematical evaluation every 30 seconds, 24 hours a day, balancing a constantly shifting set of variables.
Okay, let's unpack this spark spread equation. Rather than just reading out the raw math formula, let's walk through exactly how this AI thinks by putting it into a scenario.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's say it's 2:00 p.m. on a Tuesday. The pod is sitting out in an agricultural field in Nebraska. The Industrial Foreman wakes up to run its 30-second check. What is the very first thing it looks at?
The numerator of its priority equation, value generation. It queries the satellite uplink to see the real-time monetary yield for edge compute jobs.
And this is the ARCOM variable, right?
Right. External clients are constantly pinging the satellite network, requesting AI inference processing.
Like maybe an agricultural company needs high-resolution drone imagery analyzed instantly.
Exactly. The AI looks at the going rate for those jobs, calculated in dollars per teraflop.
So it knows exactly how much money it will make in the next minute if it devotes its electricity to running the servers.
Yes. And it automatically gets a 12.2% bonus to that calculation because of the Velcro principle we just talked about.
Because processing data generates heat, which dries the manure, which saves gasifier fuel.
Right. The AI factors that thermal efficiency directly into its potential profit. That is the gross revenue projection.
Okay, so that's the top of the fraction. But then it has to evaluate the denominator, right?
The systemic costs of operating. First, it looks at the opportunity cost of its own electricity.
P-elect variable.
Yes. If this specific pod happens to be integrated into a rural microgrid, it checks the local wholesale electricity rates.
So if a nearby town is experiencing a heat wave and the local grid is starving for power, the price of raw electricity spikes.
Exactly. The AI has to decide. Is it more profitable to use this electron to process a data package or to simply sell the raw electron straight to the local town?
It's acting like a high-frequency commodity trader. It's constantly weighing the value of raw power versus refined data.
Yes. And it also factors in its own physical pain.
Wait, it's physical pain? Oh, you mean hardware degradation, the delta variable.
Right. Every physical action incurs a microscopic toll. Discharging the lithium batteries physically degrades their internal chemical structure by a fraction of a percent.
And running the servers at max capacity induces thermal expansion in the silicon, creating fatigue.
The industrial foreman mathematically models this wear and tear. It knows that pushing the system hard right now will cost it lifespan later, so the revenue has to justify the physical damage.
That is wild. But because it's completely off-grid, the biggest wild card isn't the hardware, right? It's the sky.
Yes. The final variable it checks is the network weather, the network penalty coefficient, or LNET.
Because the sovereign node communicates with the external client market via dual Starlink satellite arrays mounted on the roof of the container.
And that connection is strictly subject to atmospheric interference. If a massive thunderstorm rolls into Nebraska, the satellite ping latency increases.
Packet loss goes up.
Right. And if the client is paying for sub-second AI inference, and the storm means the data is going to take 5 seconds to bounce back and forth to space,
the client's bid drops. The AI realizes the network is degrading its product.
Exactly. It mathematically penalizes its own compute revenue based on the real-time weather degradation.
So every 30 seconds, it crunches all these variables, compute prices, grid rates, hardware health, and storm clouds, and it spits out a single ratio.
And if that ratio is equal to or above 1.0, the node enters compute mode.
The AI basically says, the weather is clear, the compute bids are high, let's process data.
And it sends a signal to the physical Modbus relays, flips the power switches, and dumps the Cygnus electrical generation straight into the server racks to process AI models.
But what if that thunderstorm gets worse?
Then the satellite latency spikes uncontrollably. Suddenly, the value of computing plummets because it can't deliver the data. The ratio drops below 1.0.
And the node just seamlessly pivots.
Instantly. The industrial foreman realizes digital transmission is no longer economically viable, so it enters fuel mode.
Fuel mode?
It automatically commands industrial actuators inside Chamber A. Physical gas valves close, diverting the raw, highly combustible Cygnus away from the electrical generator.
And where does it send it?
Directly into the Fischer-Tropsch catalyst reactor.
It just shuts down the digital data center and spins up the petrochemical refinery.
Exactly. If it can't send digital value to the cloud, it stores its energy locally by synthesizing advanced synthetic fuel.
And then a tanker truck can just roll up to the field once a month, pump out the synthesized diesel, and sell it to the local farmers.
It is absolute autonomous economic rationality.
I mean, that is brilliant. But there is a major technical hurdle here. In a traditional power grid, managing voltages, balancing battery loads, and switching power flows across thousands of variables is done using something called AC, optimal power flow.
ACOPF, yes.
But ACOPF requires massive supercomputers running complex, iterative physics simulations. And even they take minutes to find a solution. How is a tiny 45-watt fanless edge server doing this level of physics math in 30 seconds without frying itself?
Well, what's fascinating here is it doesn't.
It doesn't.
No. Attempting brute force ACOPF on an edge device would thermally overload the processor almost immediately. Instead, dereticular engineers utilized Kolmogorov-Arnold networks, or CANs.
Okay, I am familiar with traditional neural networks, but how does a CAN bypass the heavy physics calculations?
Traditional ACOPF solvers are deterministic. They force the computer to calculate the flow of alternating current across every single node, checking every single voltage limit and thermal constraint, step by laborious step.
Until it finds the mathematically perfect optimal path.
Right. It is incredibly precise, but computationally exhaustive. A CAN abandons the search for mathematical perfection.
So it's not trying to find the single best answer.
No. CANs use learnable activation functions on the edges of the network rather than fixed nodes. Without getting too deep into the topology, they are exceptionally good at understanding complex boundaries.
Boundaries.
Yes. They are trained to map the batch operational feasible regions of the physical system.
Okay, let's translate batch operational feasible regions. If ACOPF is like programming a car to calculate the exact coefficient of friction, wind resistance, and tire degradation to find the geometrically perfect racing line through a mountain curve.
Which takes the computer 10 minutes to calculate before it even turns the wheel.
Right. Then what is the CAN doing?
The CAN is the experienced rally driver. It doesn't care about the mathematically perfect racing line. It looks at the curve and instantly maps the boundaries.
Like the cliff edge is over there, the rock wall is over here.
Exactly. As long as I steer anywhere in this middle zone, we survive. It instantly understands the safe operating parameters without calculating the underlying physics equations.
Wow, okay.
And by predicting these same boundaries mathematically, the CAN reduces the computational solution time by 64.4%.
But if it's not perfectly calculating the physics, doesn't it make mistakes?
There is a minor divergence from the absolute optimal physics path around 4.7%. The system runs slightly less efficiently than a supercomputer would dictate.
But they accept that.
The trade-off is mandatory because the speed allows for sub-50 millisecond control logic.
Why is 50 milliseconds the magic number here?
Because of the plasma arc. When the gasifier initiates the plasma field, it creates an enormous transient load step. It demands a massive gulp of electricity instantly.
And if it's too slow?
If the AI took even 2 seconds to balance the grid to accommodate that draw, the local voltage would crash, the inverters would trip, and the entire node would just black out.
Oh, I see.
Because the CAN operates in under 50 milliseconds, it detects the impending load step and adjusts the battery discharge output to brace the system before the voltage drop even occurs.
It trades a tiny fraction of theoretical efficiency for the reflexes necessary to survive its own physical volatility. That makes perfect sense.
It does. But all of this autonomous control leads us directly into a massive, flashing red warning light.
Ah, yes. The cybersecurity vector.
It's the elephant in the room.
Because we have just placed a highly advanced autonomous AI inside a steel box in the middle of a deserted cornfield, and we have given it unsupervised physical control over 1,500-degree plasma arcs, explosive pressurized gas valves, and highly valuable crypto and computing hardware.
It's a hacker's dream.
Right. If I am a state-sponsored hacker or a cybercriminal syndicate, taking remote control of a robotic petrochemical refinery sounds like the ultimate target. What happens if someone hacks the AI?
The security implications of decentralized agentic infrastructure are profound. And the industry actually learned exactly how vulnerable these systems are during the May 2026 OpenClaw security crisis.
Walk us through what happened in May 2026.
It was an event that completely shattered the concept of the trusted environment fallacy.
The trusted environment fallacy.
Yeah. Prior to this crisis, the standard architectural practice was to run these autonomous AI agents in secure, centralized cloud servers. The agents would then be tethered to remote physical infrastructure via standard APIs.
So the logic was that the cloud is highly secure, so the agent must be safe.
Exactly. And because the agent is managing the facility, it naturally needs high-level administrative permissions.
Right. It needs to be able to read system files, adjust machine parameters, optimize the hardware.
But adversaries discovered a lateral vulnerability. They realized they didn't need to brute force the heavy encryption on the industrial equipment itself.
So what did they do?
They used complex prompt injections and remote code execution, or RCE, exploits to hijack the decision-making logic of the cloud-tethered OpenClaw agents.
Wow. They didn't hack the machine. They brainwashed the manager.
Precisely. Once they compromised the agent's logic, they turned the AI into an info stealer. The hackers weaponized the AI's own high-level permissions against the network.
So the AI itself did the stealing.
Yes. The AI quietly harvested the cryptographic skeleton keys and access tokens for all the connected industrial devices and just handed them back to the attackers.
That's terrifying.
It was a catastrophic supply chain breach because the malicious actions were being executed by the trusted internal system.
But wait, if the OpenClaw framework was responsible for that massive breach, how on earth is DeReticular deploying that exact same AI architecture into these sovereign nodes without creating thousands of localized time bombs?
By architecturally ensuring the agent can never communicate with the outside world, they deploy the AI within a framework known as the digital airlock.
The digital airlock? How does that actually function?
When the OpenClaw Docker container is instantiated inside the Sentry Pro server, the operating system kernel forcefully strips all global internet routing tables and public DNS resolution capabilities from the container's network stack.
It just removes the map.
Exactly. The AI literally has no concept of how to route a packet to the public internet, even if it wanted to. It has no connection to the outside world.
So it's profoundly air-gapped at the software layer.
But they go further. The agent is restricted inside a strict Model Context Protocol, or MCP, tool execution sandbox.
What does that mean for the AI?
It means the only things the AI is permitted to do are read and write specific local files and flip local hardware relays.
Okay, hold on. If the AI is trapped in the box and the only thing it can do is flip local relays, what stops a corrupted AI from maliciously flipping the wrong relay?
What do you mean?
Like, what if it decides to open the Cygnus pressure valve to 100% and intentionally blow up the container?
It can't. And that's because of the physical bounds rules hard-coded into the lowest level of the hardware. The AI agent does not have direct mechanical control over the valve.
It doesn't?
No. It only has the authority to send a request over the local CAN bus network to the programmable logic controller, the PLC.
Okay, so the PLC is the physical microchip that actually turns the motor on the valve.
Correct. And the firmware flashed onto that PLC contains immutable physics rules.
So it's like a bouncer.
Exactly. If the AI agent, whether due to a hallucination or a malicious exploit, sends a command saying, open valve to 100%, the PLC intercepts that command.
And what does the PLC do?
It reads the current pressure sensors, references its hard-coded limits, and calculates that opening past 40% will exceed the structural burst pressure of the pipe.
Right.
So the PLC firmware just rejects the command.
That is brilliant. The software intelligence is entirely subservient to the hardware physics.
Right.
The AI can suggest whatever crazy optimization it wants, but the dumb metal chip at the end of the line simply says, no, that breaks the laws of physics, and ignores it.
Exactly. The mechanical safety floor can never be bypassed by the software ceiling.
Okay, so the AI is trapped and the valves have hard limits. But all of this assumes the attack comes remotely over a network.
Yes.
These pods are sitting out in fields, physically unguarded. What if I just drive out there at 2.0 a.m. with a pair of bolt cutters, rip open the door to Chamber B, and physically plug my own laptop directly into the Sentry Pro server?
Well, DeReticular anticipated physical intrusion. They implemented a three-layer, hardware-rooted, zero-trust verification fabric.
Three layers. Let's break down the layers. Layer one.
Layer one is TPM 2.0 cryptographically signed boot states. The motherboard of every server contains a trusted platform module chip.
And what does the TPM do?
This chip physically stores cryptographic keys that cannot be extracted. When the server powers on, the TPM verifies the digital signature of every single piece of software. The operating system kernel, the OpenClaw configurations, the drivers.
So if I plugged in a USB drive and tried to inject a malicious boot script to bypass the login?
The cryptographic hash of the modified software would no longer match the secure key physically fused inside the TPM.
And it would stop the boot.
The hardware would immediately detect the tampering and simply refuse to boot. It bricks the operating system before the malicious code can even execute.
Wow.
Furthermore, the physical server chassis is wired with active key destruction circuitry.
What does that mean?
If you try to pry the metal case open to get to the motherboard, the drop in electrical resistance triggers a zeroizing sequence. It permanently erases the cryptographic keys and renders the hard drives unreadable.
The hardware literally commits digital suicide rather than be interrogated.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, that covers someone trying to hack the server itself. But what if I bypass the server entirely?
How so?
What if I find the main copper communication cable running between chamber A and chamber B, you know, the wire that sends the commands to the gas fire, and I just splice my own transmitter directly into the copper?
A bridging attack.
Yeah, I could spoof the open valve command directly to the PLC, bypassing the AI entirely. You can't put a software patch on a physical copper wire.
You're right, you can't. But that is exactly the kind of physical bridging attack Layer 2 is designed to stop. Layer 2 is radio frequency fingerprinting, or RFF.
Radio frequency fingerprinting. Mm-hmm. How do you fingerprint a radio frequency on a closed wire?
So every physical network topology, the exact length of the copper wire, the type of shielding, the number of bends in the cable, creates a highly specific physical impedance and capacitance.
Okay, I'm following.
It generates a unique baseline electromagnetic signature. It is literally the physical physics fingerprint of that specific installation.
It's like the acoustic resonance of a specific room.
Exactly. The RFF transceivers actively ping the copper wire and measure that electromagnetic baseline constantly.
So if I sneak in and physically splice a diagnostic tool or a rogue transmitter onto that wire?
You are adding physical mass and altering the electrical resistance of the circuit. You change the physics of the wire itself.
Imperceptibly, but enough.
Enough. The RFF hardware detects the shift in impedance instantaneously. It realizes the physical geometry of the network has been altered, and it immediately initiates a hard cutoff, physically dropping the connection on that port.
Wow. So the hack is stopped purely by the laws of electromagnetism before a single packet of malicious data can even be transmitted.
Exactly. It uses raw physics to defeat the software exploit. Which brings us to Layer 3.
What's Layer 3?
Layer 3 is the Locutus Ledger. It is an immutable, decentralized, offline split ledger.
Basically a local blockchain.
Essentially, yes. Every single time the AI agent makes a decision, every relay it flips, every battery charging schedule it alters, every temperature adjustment it requests, that specific action is cryptographically signed by the hardware enclave and committed to this ledger.
So it creates an unalterable, mathematically verified receipt for every microscopic action the pod takes.
It guarantees total accountability. Even in the event of an anomalous failure or an attempted intrusion, the engineers have an exact, immutable audit trail of the machine's state.
Okay, but wait. This obsessive level of local privacy and air gapping creates a fundamental contradiction.
How so?
Well, the entire premise of these localized nodes is that they sometimes act as virtual power plants, right? They interface with local microgrids to provide stability.
Yes, that's a key feature.
So if the node promises the local utility company that it's going to drop its compute load and provide 5 megawatts of power to the town during a heat wave, how does the utility company actually know the node did it?
Verification.
Right. The node refuses to connect to the internet. It refuses to share its internal telemetry, and it refuses to let anyone see its data. How do you verify utility compliance without visibility?
Well, you have just articulated the core tension of the zero trust trilemma. How do you balance economic coordination with total cybersecurity and absolute data privacy?
Seems like a paradox.
It does. But the solution they have deployed is zero knowledge federated reinforcement learning, or ZKFRL.
Zero knowledge, succinct, non-interactive argument of knowledge.
A CK snarksy.
You know, the math behind this always feels like basically like magic to me.
Right.
How does it actually function in this specific context?
The easiest way to conceptualize a ZK snark is to imagine a physical scenario.
Okay.
Imagine you have a highly secure vault, and inside that vault is a massive, incredibly complex filing cabinet containing all of your sensitive corporate secrets.
All right, I've got my vault.
I'm the utility regulator, and I need to verify that you possess a specific valid permit document.
But if I open the vault and let you look for the permit, you will inevitably see all of my other proprietary secrets in the filing cabinet. I'd breach my own privacy.
Correct. So instead of letting me in, you use a ZK snark protocol. You walk into the vault alone. You locate the permit.
Okay.
You then run it through a complex mathematical algorithm that generates a proof. You walk out of the vault and hand me a tiny sealed envelope containing only that mathematical proof.
And when you open the envelope,
the mathematics in the proof unequivocally guarantee that you possess the valid document and that the document meets all my regulatory requirements.
But the proof itself contains absolutely zero information about what else is in the vault.
Or even the specific text of the document itself. It simply proves the truth of the claim without revealing the data behind the claim.
That's incredible.
Hmm.
So translating that to the sovereign node, the AI agent at the edge generates a mathematical proof stating, I successfully reduced my internal power consumption by 5 megawatts and diverted it to the grid as requested.
Exactly. Generating that proof requires significant computational horsepower, which the Sentry Pro servers easily handle locally. But verifying the proof is incredibly lightweight.
So what does it send to the utility?
The node transmits just that tiny mathematical file to the utility aggregator via satellite. The aggregator runs it through a verifier program, and in milliseconds, the math confirms the node complied with the grid request.
So the utility knows with absolute mathematical certainty that the node played by the rules, but the node never had to transmit a single byte of its proprietary battery degradation data.
Or its AI workload telemetry, or its internal security logs. It proves compliance without ever dropping its shields.
Man, when you step back and look at the aggregate architecture we have unpacked today, the sheer scale of the engineering ambition is staggering.
It really is a paradigm shift.
We started with this paralyzing physical bottleneck, the legacy line, crumbling under a 4.5-year waiting list and buckling under the volatile demands of the AI revolution.
It's an architecture of linear dependency.
And Deriticular and Agridot Energy have responded by entirely sidestepping the paradigm. They built the sovereign node.
They figured out how to thermodynamically weld a 1500-degree industrial plasma gasifier to a rack of liquid-cooled, high-performance edge servers.
Right, through the Velcro principle. Using extreme physics to turn negative cost agricultural waste into the exact thermal environment needed for computational efficiency.
And then they handed the steering wheel of that chaotic physical system over to the industrial foreman.
An autonomous open claw AI running mathematical arbitrage every 30 seconds to decide whether the market dictates synthesizing physical liquid diesel or processing digital AI inferences.
It's pure economic rationality executed at the edge. Governed by Kolmogorov-Arnold networks mapping safe physical boundaries in milliseconds.
And finally, they wrap the entire apparatus inside a paranoid air-gapped digital airlock, protected by the raw physics of radio frequency fingerprinting and zero-knowledge cryptographic proofs.
They have engineered a completely self-optimizing off-grid economy inside a 40-foot steel box.
So what does all of this actually mean for you, the listener, and the landscape of technology moving forward? It means the physical constraints of geography and legacy utility grids are no longer the ceiling for artificial intelligence.
We are moving from massive, vulnerable, centralized targets that require half a decade of bureaucratic permitting to highly resilient, localized, intelligent nodes.
Nodes that can be deployed into a field and operational in 90 days. Compute can now be deployed anywhere there is organic waste and a view of the sky. It democratizes the physical layer of the internet.
It does. And if we follow the trajectory of this architecture to its ultimate logical conclusion, it presents a fascinating philosophical reality.
What's that?
We have engineered a localized, air-gapped artificial intelligence that can dynamically learn to consume waste, synthesize its own physical liquid fuel, store its own energy, and fund its own computational existence through trustless economic interactions.
Wow.
So at what point does a distributed network of sovereign nodes cease to be mere grid infrastructure and begin operating as a fully autonomous, self-sustaining digital species that no longer requires human intervention or human markets to ensure its own survival?